Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, the environment, and more. We're going to open the show today talking about the many ways you can support and assist the more than 4,000 children waiting for foster and adoptive care across the state with the Connecticut Alliance of Foster and Adoptive Families. We're also going to hear about their important partnership with the Mattress Firm Foster Kids Initiative that's hosting three different collections at their stores in Connecticut, including a back-to-school supplies drive going on now. Then we're going to chat with a local veterinarian and founder of the Connecticut Veterinary Medical Foundation to talk about a number of important issues involving veterinarians across Connecticut who are committed to taking the best care possible of your beloved furry friends. And we'll close with Connecticut's DEEP, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, which just released its draft updated energy strategy, focusing on building a 21st century energy system to lower costs for homeowners and businesses while reducing carbon emissions to help achieve the state's climate change goals. DEEP is looking for you to read and comment on the report, and we'll be talking with the agency's Deputy Commissioner of Energy to hear all about it. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Sikorsky and Teamsters Local 1150 is holding their 7th annual Home Run for Heroes event August 19th to honor and support local military veterans and their families. The public is invited to attend this family-friendly event, complete with a helicopter landing, music, food, and, of course, baseball. It's starting at 11 a.m. at the stadium at Harbor Yard in Bridgeport, honoring military heroes and raising money for four local veterans organizations. And, of course, it will feature some great baseball, too, as the Bridgeport Bluefish take on the New Britain Bees at noon. Just come down to the ballpark and be part of the fun while honoring and supporting the Connecticut Veterans Legal Center, Connecticut Fallen Heroes Foundation, the Harkness House, Columbus House, and Female Soldiers Forgotten Heroes. Well, you'll occasionally hear us talking about a number of issues surrounding foster and adoption initiatives here in Connecticut. And I'm so pleased to be able to have the privilege to highlight a couple of them that are going on in tandem. The first is in regards to Mattress Firm Foster Kids Initiative, which we'll talk about in just a little while. The big news is that they're currently collecting supplies for their back-to-school supply drive at all of the Mattress Firm locations, not just across Connecticut, but wherever you're listening to me. Chances are, if you're within relevant distance of a Mattress Firm, they're collecting somewhere. So if you happen to be checking out the show on iTunes or on the web and you're interested in helping out, it's a good and easy way to do it. So I'm pleased to also bring on the program the representative of an organization I'm very familiar with, but a new friend that I'm making this morning. Margaret Doherty is on the line with us. She's executive director of the Connecticut Alliance of Foster and Adoptive Families. Margaret, thanks for coming on board.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So as we kind of discussed off the air, just on the night before our interview, I had the privilege of being invited to a little boutique event at a location in northern Fairfield County that was sponsored by DCF. It was a foster and adoptive workshop. And there were some pretty disturbing and concerning statistics, which we'll get into in a little while. But when folks are curious about learning whether or not they can qualify or are interested in becoming a foster or even an adoptive family, there are myriad places, if they Google it, where they're going to get sent. In Connecticut, if I understand correctly, the Department of Children and Families plays a huge role in both facilitating and overseeing organizations or partnering with organizations like yours. Can you tell us a little bit about the background and the role that the Connecticut Alliance of Foster and Adoptive Families kind of plays in that greater quilt work of good?
Sure. We have actually, our organization has had a contract with the Department of Children and Families since 1995, And we serve sort of as the nonprofit partner and sister to the Department of Children and Families in Connecticut. So we assist the department in recruiting potential foster and adoptive families, supporting them once they become licensed through a whole set of services, including offering post-licensing training, peer support in the form of a buddy. If you're a newly licensed family, then you have an assigned buddy. We also have liaisons, one employee per the 14 offices in the Connecticut Department of Children and Families. So there's a lot of support that we offer, as well as, you know, participating in fun events with families, and, you know, keeping a great community together in Connecticut. And when you mentioned the recruitment and, you know, people who are interested in becoming foster or adoptive parents and families, all over Connecticut you'll see 1-888-KID-HERO.
Mm-hmm.
So the Kid Hero line is the central intake for information about fostering and adopting in Connecticut. And that line is answered here in our Rocky Hill office from 8 in the morning until 8 o'clock at night, Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. And we also follow up on anybody who goes to the DCF website or comes to our website and says, hey, I'd like information about fostering and adopting. We respond to all of those internet inquiries as well. And we'll direct people to the local DCF office closest to their home or to their business if they would, you know, prefer to do that. Mm-hmm. And we get them into an open house and they learn information about what it takes to be a foster and adoptive family.
And I imagine if folks call 211 info line, you'll be one of the top or the prime referral if they're calling after hours or
yes.
around weekends and such.
Yes, that's correct.
Very good. So 1-888-KID-HERO or info line nights and weekends for folks that might be interested in getting information. Asking for information is another thing, Margaret, that I think people that are on the fence or that are just exploring the concept of possibly being a foster and adoptive parent, I hope they don't think that by calling the number, they're sort of logged into some sort of a network and that there's some expectation that they'll follow through. I think it's important to reinforce to people that you not only welcome anyone who's interested in information, but also affirm that maybe people who call will not even begin the process or begin entertaining seriously becoming involved in this initiative for months or even years.
That's absolutely correct. There's no real good statistic out there about this, but we know anecdotally over the years that many times it takes 2 to 3 years before, you know, a family is ready to commit. They've thought about it. They've gotten some information. They've talked to friends. They may have gone to an open house at a DCF office and then thought, you know, well, I'll think about it. And, you know, it's a big commitment. We encourage people to make sure that, you know, if they're ready to step forward, that they have the support of their family and friends, you know, coworkers, because we know that the support of family and friends is one of the biggest biggest reasons or why people stay as foster parents. When we survey folks, they say that the support of their family and friends is one of the biggest reasons why they continue to be able to do the work that they do in fostering.
The other
thing that really resonated with me just last night when I attended an open house to impart kind of prep for this interview, but also to be developing some other reporting on the issue, was the reinforcement that when people get involved, although when they're called and asked and they agree, there's not often or almost never an opportunity to kind of test the waters with the incoming child or teenager before they are committed to at least overseeing and caring for these kids. However, both the DCF and networks like yours work really hard in the preparation process to define as close as possible the right child and the right type of personality or situation or age or even medical status or the needs or special needs of that child, because there are loads of foster parents that are spectacularly good with infants but really aren't interested or don't have the same type of talent or gift with teenagers, and vice versa. There's some that just would like teenagers. There's some that will work to become certified to care sometimes with 24-hour nursing for medically and severely medically compromised children. And then there are others who are particularly good and can open their home to the many siblings who you like to try to keep together if they are suddenly taken away from their biological parents. So there's a lot of work up to make sure anybody who gets involved in this program is ultimately as successful as they can be.
That's absolutely correct. And I will say we mostly hear very positive reports from foster parents that the DCF employees did go out of their way to try to accommodate and carefully match up a child with a family. So, there are times when it's an emergency placement, and you know, DCF is really reliant on foster parents saying, "Okay, you know, I have room in my home, and yes, I'll welcome this child that you know has to be removed from his or her family tonight." But there's also a lot of very careful consideration that goes into trying to properly match a child with a family. It doesn't do anybody any good to not take the time to try to make that happen.
Very good. Once again, 1-888-KID-HERO is the phone number to call to either get directly through or get on the list to get called back by the Connecticut Alliance of Foster and Adoptive Families. They're working with Mattress Firm here in Connecticut, and Mattress Firm is working with similar agencies across the country, no matter where you're listening. They are currently engaged in their school supply drive, so you can bring things like backpacks, crayons, pens, binders, and back-to-school stuff to any of the red donation bins in the Mattress Firm stores across Connecticut. And as this program broadcasts, you've got two more weeks for that. It ends on August 27th as we broadcast this on the 13th. And then, literally, the next day, they pick up with a shoe drive, which runs through Halloween, August 28th through October 31st. And then immediately the next day, November 1st through December 17th, there's the Secret Santa toy drive. So shifting gears a little bit, Margaret, you guys have found a really incredible partner in Mattress Firm here. It seems like the Mattress Firm Foster Kids Initiative really gets it and is serving a critically important role, not just here in Connecticut, but around the country.
You're absolutely right. It's amazing. Just I can't begin to articulate how impressed we are with the support that Mattress Firm has given to kids throughout the country. We're thrilled that we were asked in 2016 to apply to be one of their partners, and they selected us. They have been almost at least, well, once a month, every 2 months, we either get a significant dollar donation or we get a significant donation of pillows, school supplies, pajamas, toys, shoes. They've been absolutely incredible. And I know from talking and working closely with my counterparts throughout the country, the company has done the same in other states, and it's incredible, the support. It's not only, you know, the gifts that they give to the children, but the public awareness that they have brought on these issues. So, you know, we know that there are a lot of families that say, I can't be a foster family, I can't adopt any children, but I can support those that do by donating, you know, directly to the children or through dollar contributions. Some people actually become mentors to teenagers who are in foster care, so there's tons of ways to help, and Mattress Firm really is leading the way.
And we need to make sure people understand you're not obliged or going to get hit with hard sales pitches when you walk through the door just to make a donation. They are simply the partner of the adoption and foster initiatives across the country. These red boxes are there. You walk in with your school supplies up until August 27th, drop them right in the box, smile and wave, and be on your way, or take advantage of the products and services that Mattress Firm offers. If you are unable or not available to help with the school supply drive, which ends 2 weeks from today on August 27th, beginning the very next day is their shoe drive. So you can find out all about that. That runs through Halloween. And then the Secret Santa toy drive kicks off the very next day, November 1st, and runs all the way into mid-December. So that ends on December 17th. So three opportunities between now and the end of the year to visit Mattress Firm. And you don't have to buy a mattress or anything like that. You can just go and help with their Mattress Firm Foster Kids Initiative. Margaret Doherty has been on the line with us. She's Executive Director of the Connecticut Alliance of Foster and Adoptive Families. Right now in Connecticut, well over 4,000 children need a loving, caring foster or adoptive home. We hope you'll call 1-888-KID-HERO to find out more. If you don't see your involvement happening for years down the road or months down the road, or you just want information, call 1-888-KID-HERO and try to do what you can for one of these more than 4,000 kids in Connecticut who need a loving, caring place to go in crisis. Margaret, thanks so much for being part of the program. Well, this segment is dedicated to all of the pet owners in Connecticut and within the sounds of our voices. I am so pleased to welcome a very important guest to the program this morning. I have on the line with me Dr. Arnold Arnie Goldman, who is a graduate of the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine and University of Minnesota School of Public Health, where he earned his Master of Public Health degree in 2011. He's owned and operated Canton Animal Hospital since 1995, and he's been very active in the Veterinary Medical Association leadership for almost 20 years. He served in many positions on the board of directors of the Connecticut Veterinary Medical Association, including as president and chair and co-chair of the Government Affairs Committee, Ethics Grievance Committee, Disaster Preparedness Committee, and on their Diversity Committee. So he's worn a lot of hats in the world of veterinary medicine, and I'm only about four sentences into the several paragraphs of his bio, so we won't waste a lot more time on that. If folks want to learn a little bit more about Dr. Goldman, you can certainly check that out on your own. But what brings him to the program today is his recent visit and speaking at the AVMA's National Convention in Indianapolis, where he referenced the importance of veterinarian medicine advancing with the digital age. And that has brought him around to our program. So, Dr. Goldman, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
And John, thank you so much for having me. It's quite a pleasure and an honor.
So the important thing that I think we need to really start discussing today is how veterinarians, for the most part, especially ones that folks will tend to be patronizing, the hundreds or maybe even thousands across Connecticut, many of whom are working hard to stay current and advanced. They're very proactive in their training, and they're also utilizing the most, or you know, among the most state-of-the-art practices, technology, and equipment in the delivery of healthcare for our beloved pets.
Well, the what you're referring to, I believe, is the whole idea of telehealth or telemedicine. Telehealth is the application of digital technologies to interact with patients, and that's in any type of medical profession, but in our cases, of course, the patients are animals. And, you know, it's been a hot topic of discussion because probably not known by most people, veterinarians have been practicing telemedicine in certain ways for many, many years. It goes to speaking on the telephone with specialists. For 35 years, it's been possible to transmit electrocardiograms digitally over telephone lines. And now, of course, with computers, it's much simpler to interact with all sorts of specialists. Many veterinarians submit their X-ray images to radiology specialists just for confirmation and sometimes to help with difficult diagnoses, because we have specialists in many, many fields, and some of them make themselves available to a broader audience in that manner. Another thing that veterinarians have long done is many of us belong to one or more sort of digital communication listservs. So there's one in particular called Veterinary Information Network. There's another one, NOAH. All of us interact with specialists in that regard. What's changed now is the technology has trickled down in some ways to regular people, pet owners. And so the debate is, how ethical is it to interact with pets and pet owners solely by digital means? And the feeling of the profession is that whatever helps patients and helps clients afford and achieve the health of their pets the best that's possible, you know, that's reasonable up to a point. And that up to a point is that we don't feel that it's completely ethical to begin a relationship solely via Skype or any of these electronic methods, because animals can't speak to us, and we know from experience that, you know, coughing and vomiting look alike in cats. Dogs sometimes hide their symptoms. You know, limping might be a knee, it might be a hip. Would be something else, and so it's quite difficult. You can't ask an animal specific questions while someone else is examining it. So basically what I'm saying is, for the start of a new relationship with an owner and their animal, a hands-on physical exam and a personal interaction, at least at the outset, is very important. And then from there, if you're managing a chronic condition, if you are answering a simple question that's not involving a new diagnosis, for say, then, you know, digital technologies certainly have their place. And there has been a lot of discussion about it, because in some cases there have been people with a different point of view. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I mean, in people, you know, get advice from physicians sometimes via telephonic means or via computers, and everybody's pretty careful to acknowledge that there are limitations in that. And so it's not just my profession, but throughout the medical professions, human professions as well, there's a lot of debate about just how accurate and how ethical some of this type of communication is. And so we've sort of figured out that at least at the beginning of a relationship, there has to be a hands-on physical exam and a good relationship started between an owner and their animal. Otherwise, you know, we all know that it's even when you are in person, it's easy to get fooled. You know, when we we work up an animal for an illness, we rarely put one name on what's possible. We make what we call a differential diagnosis list of the 7 or 8 things it could be, and then we cross each one off as a test or a further evaluation indicates, and hopefully we're left with one correct diagnosis.
So on that point, what I think I'm hearing is, if you're a pet owner and you love your pet, don't be enticed into a situation out of anticipated economical advantage by initiating a first time relationship with a veterinarian via a non-hands-on situation.
Yeah, and there are entities and people selling that, and I think they're doing pets and their owners a disservice to some extent with that.
Very good.
You know, it's we all are attentive to the financial concerns of owners. I mean, I never give people just one plan. You know, there's always options, and we try to work with everybody as an individual and provide them a choice. You know, the last thing you want to do is force somebody into something they really didn't want.
Yeah.
And if the, you know, so it's, that's what I'm saying.
Very good. Before we go to break, come back and talk about things like infectious disease, the opioid crisis in relation to our pet ownership, and issues related to the shift towards the adoption of imported dogs, which we'll take up after the break. In the last minute or two that we have before we go to break, Doctor, could you please just talk for a moment or two about how much veterinary medicine has advanced. 15, 20 years ago, perhaps there were occasional practices that may have had the same type of medical technology that was availed to humans in clinics and hospitals and doctor's office. But today, there is a much greater proliferation of in-office technologies that help people like you do your work better on behalf of our pets.
Yeah, that's exactly right, John. I mean, there's been two things that have occurred over the last 20, 25 years. It has been a wider availability of specialists, and their expertise has trickled down, and the standard of care that's expected by many, if not most, pet owners is quite a bit higher than it was some years back. And also the development of technologies that allow us to find things out without avoiding surgery or avoiding some other more invasive tests many times. It's not, you know, that's been a great big change. It's not uncommon to see ultrasound machines in regular general practitioners' practices, with many veterinarians having a really high level of expertise. And here and there, you're starting to see MRIs and CT scans available in shared settings, unheard of 20 years ago. So, basically, pets are getting better care, and of course, you know, it does at times add to the cost, but you have to weigh that against not having an accurate diagnosis and, of course, having a desire to get your pet well. And so a balance has to be struck in that regard, but veterinary medicine has come a long way, and we're always lagging human medicine to some extent, but we're much closer now than we were years ago.
Very good. Dr. Goldman is a founder of the Connecticut Veterinary Medical Foundation as the charitable and service arm of the CVMA and has innovated many of its programs. He has been in practice with the Canton Animal Hospital since 1995. We've got him for about 8 or 9 more minutes right after the break. Please stick with us while we continue our conversation with Dr. Arnie Goldman. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The United Healthcare Children's Foundation is actively seeking grant applications from Connecticut families in need of financial assistance to help pay for their child's healthcare treatments, services, or equipment not covered or fully covered by their commercial health insurance plans. Qualifying families can receive up to $5,000 annually per child to help pay for medical services and equipment. If you'd like to learn more and to apply, parents or legal guardians should visit UHCCF.org. That's UHCCF.org. All right. Thanks for sticking with us. We got a lot of pet lovers out there that are very, very invested in this conversation. I hope Dr. Arnie Goldman is with us.
I am.
He is. And he is the owner and operator of the Canton Animal Hospital in Canton, Connecticut. Dr. Goldman, if you didn't catch the beginning of the program, recently spoke at the American Veterinary Medical Association's National Conference in Indianapolis, where he was talking about the importance of veterinarian medicine advancing with the digital age. Sadly, one of the things that's advancing right now, both in Connecticut and across the country, is the opioid crisis. And until I got a few prompting points, I never thought this subject would come up in an interview with a veterinarian. But now I see why. And we'll have Dr. Goldman explain why the opioid crisis is impacting the veterinary profession. Dr. Goldman, what do you have to say about that?
Thank you, John. Well, there's a number of different considerations. For the purposes of the public's ability to access the kind of care they want, it has become, and we understand why, much, much more difficult to prescribe pain relief medications. Perhaps people don't know, but in cases of surgery and more serious illnesses, you know, we use many of the same medications as people take for serious pain, and many of them include the opioid class. And, of course, in the interest of protecting the public, the state government has passed a series of laws which makes prescribing a little more difficult because we, like all medical practitioners, are expected to do our research through websites that are provided by the state government to make sure that people are not doctor shopping.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little harder to fool a veterinarian because we do our physical exams on animals, and if we don't identify a source of pain, you know, we are typically not one to prescribe just because.
Sure.
And so it's very difficult to fool us. But that said, you know, I understand the public purpose of more closely regulating those medications. But mm-hmm. It has become more difficult. You have to justify it more and give out less medication at a time, and of course that means the owners have to come back more often or go to the pharmacy more often. Pharmacists are sometimes reluctant to dispense on the order of a veterinarian, so we've had those issues. Other issues related to working dogs and police dogs with the sort of efforts to suppress improperly used legal drugs, there's been a proliferation of more powerful illegal drugs, as mm-hmm. we all know, particularly fentanyl and carfentanil, which I'm learning that police dogs of various kinds are being, and police officers, are being affected by these drugs. The powder is so light that just disturbing it gets it in the air, and it affects our officers, whether human or canine.
Yes.
So that's a big issue today, and you know this problem, I don't know what the ultimate solution is, but suffice it to say, you know, we're part of the solution, not the problem.
Very good.
There are, so.
No, I'm sorry. I just want to make sure we're getting through these other points in the last 4 or 5 minutes that we have. It's interesting. I just had a conversation with somebody a couple of days ago who was saying, well, I know my dog has been bitten by ticks and they haven't been pulled off immediately. They've probably, had a blood meal on the dog. The ticks are engorged a little bit. And I'm hearing that maybe they should be vaccinated against Lyme disease or the other tick-borne illnesses that humans can contract. Can you speak to some of the concerns and the maybe the misinformation that's out there in relation to of the most important vaccines?
Sure can. I'll hit on two things. Yeah, tick-borne disease is a very big deal, especially up here in the Northeast, but in other locations as well. I mean, Lyme disease is named after Lyme, Connecticut, sure. So it's definitely a clue that it's an important disease here. And that's not the only disease that ticks carry. They carry a number of other ones, the most common being anaplasmosis and Ehrlichia, as well as some other less-known diseases, especially in ticks from the South and other places. But suffice it to say, every pet owner in Connecticut needs to take a sort of a broad approach to tick prevention. You know, fleas are a problem more so in other areas. We do see them here, but ticks are a far more widespread problem in Connecticut than fleas. And ticks are harder to prevent and harder to kill. They're just hardier. Mm. But environmental suppression of the ticks through keeping the weeds and grass cut a distance from your house, giving your animals a tick prevention that's safe and effective for them. And then, in the case of dogs at least, vaccinating them against Lyme disease. The vaccine's not perfect. It's 85% effective, but that's better than zero. And we see so many animals with tick-borne disease. So that's just an important thing for any Connecticut pet owner. Another big element in infectious disease today are these two influenzas that have arisen over the last few years. H3N8 and H3N2 are influenzas that directly affect dogs, and they pop up in pockets, often starting in locations where dogs congregate. And then, of course, these days, dogs are moving vast distances to be adopted in our state and other states, and so sometimes new diseases travel great distances along with those animals and then affect animals here who may not have any natural immunity to such new things. And that brings me to vaccination. There is a group of people who fear vaccinations. There has been some faulty medical literature in the past. There was a paper in England some years back that tried to link autism to a preservative that is no longer used in vaccines. Mm. The paper was debunked. The doctor lost his license. But nevertheless, the myth has remained. And many people, some vocal minority of people, I recently read in the New York City area, fear that their dogs will get autism if they vaccinate them. And so that is sort of a double myth. Dogs are not known to get that particular mental illness, and vaccines do not cause autism. Mm-hmm. Although there are people that believe that. That has never been shown to be so. So, those are hot topics today of discussion because it's been in the news.
Very good. So in the last minute that we have with you, how can people learn more about some of these hot topics and access bona fide literature and background so that they can make the right decisions when it comes to their pets?
Excellent question, and thank you for it. I think it's, there's a lot of information on the Internet, but it's important what sites you choose. I can always recommend the public get information from the American Veterinary Medical Association, AVMA.org website. You can also get information from many of the colleges of veterinary medicine across the country. In this area, we have the Tufts University College of Veterinary Medicine in Grafton, Massachusetts. They have an informative website, as well as does Cornell in Ithaca, New York, and the University of Pennsylvania in the greater Philadelphia area. Great. And there are schools across the country, and those are often the best information sources, AVMA and the schools. And then there's another website called veterinarypartner.com, and that is always regularly updated. with information that's suitable for the public. And, you know, it's written in plain English and not in medical ease.
Much like our interview today. It was fantastic information, and we probably have lots more to talk about. I would be happy to visit with you again in a few months, so we can catch up on some things maybe that are pertinent to our crazy winters here or springtime issues in Connecticut. So I look forward to having it back. Dr. Arnie Goldman is a local veterinarian and owner of the Canton Animal Hospital. He recently spoke at the American Veterinary Medical Association's National Convention in Indianapolis. He's been in practice since 1995 and founder of the Connecticut Veterinary Medical Foundation. I learned a lot, Dr. Goldman. Thank you so much for being part of the program. Well, we often check in with our friends at the Connecticut Department of Environment, Energy and Environmental Protection, DEEP, for a range of subjects. I continue to be shocked and amazed at how many different ways Connecticut DEEP gets involved in our communities and in our lives, everything from the air we breathe to the water we drink and to the energy we consume. And you may not have heard, but Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection just released a draft of an updated energy strategy for Connecticut, which focuses on building a 21st century energy system that lowers costs for homeowners and businesses and reduces carbon emissions to help achieve the state's climate change goals. They are going to be hosting various public information meetings that actually begin in Willimantic tomorrow on August 14th, and they continue in Bridgeport on the 16th, in New London on the 21st, in Torrington on the 29th, and in Hartford on the 6th. There's also one scheduled in New Haven at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station in September 7th. So if there's something that you hear on this program that piques your interest, they'd be happy to hear you. And this kind of dovetails really well into our recent visits with folks talking about the Connecticut Draft Water Plan and other initiatives. So we're so pleased to meet and make the acquaintance of Mary Soto. She's on the line with us. She is the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection's Deputy Commissioner for Energy. Mary, great to meet you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So let's dig right in here. Since the establishment of DEEP versus the DEP back in 2011 and the release of the state's first ever comprehensive energy strategy 2 years later, Connecticut has really been putting energy policies and programs in place with an eye toward the future. And Connecticut is now being looked to as a national leader in addressing various changes in energy policies and systems and climate change. Tell us a little bit about the background and the lead up to the 2017 strategy and draft that is now going to be talked about through these course of public meetings.
Sure. Well, you know, as you mentioned, our first comprehensive energy strategy was published about 4 years ago, and it teed up some specific, recommendations and strategies for the state to pursue trying to achieve cleaner, cheaper, more reliable energy. So that's the same mantra, I think, that we use today to guide our decisions. But you know, the strategies that were teed up in 2013, have yielded some very interesting results. And so that's a lot of what we were analyzing this time around was looking at, for instance, we made a big push to do large-scale renewable energy procurements. So that's where we, in the Energy Bureau, actually solicit, large-scale wind, solar, offshore wind, fuel cells, all types of renewable energy, as well as energy efficiency and storage, you know, other resources that are providing a similar benefit to the grid to give us their projects. So we made some selections of over 400 megawatts of renewable energy for the state, And so we, you know, based on that kind of experience, we said, well, what can we learn from this, and how does that inform our strategy going forward? One of the things we learned was that the pricing, the actual cost of those kind of projects, has been coming down tremendously over the last several years. So what that tells us is that we actually can get increasingly clean energy for cheaper, you know, than we have in the past. So that's great news.
Mm-hmm.
And has informed our focus this year on actually expanding our state's renewable portfolio standard. So that's the amount of renewable energy we require the utilities to procure. We've increased that. We are recommending an increase of that to be 30% by 2030. We are currently operating under a requirement to have 20% by 2020.
Mm. Well, I think it is most awesome when you look at initiatives that not only have the impact of proliferating amongst consumers at a lower cost to them to acquire, but even initiatives that passively provide economic advantages to utility consumers and energy consumers, and collaterally also help save the planet or preserve and protect, lower carbon emissions and impact global warming, or at least work in some small way that we can in our tiny little state against the global damage that's been done so far and continues to be done. Speaking to that, from your perspective, and maybe not even in terms of the philosophy of the DEEP, but yourself and given your background, could you just convey to folks that are listening how much of a difference that the kind of work Connecticut is doing could potentially have a positive impact on a national or even global scale?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we can't underestimate how important the actions and the policies that we pursue here are for both, as you mentioned, for the country and internationally. At a national level, you know, Connecticut has been a part of the sort of first wave innovation in a lot of areas in the energy space, one being the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which we refer to as REGGI. So that was the first carbon cap and trade program for the power sector that we and many other states here in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic have been a part of for, gosh, now almost, I think, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, you've now seen California adopt a program to a similar cap and trade program. Those were the same ideas that the EPA had used in its formulation of the Clean Power Plan, you know, focused on these market-based mechanisms to drive down carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way that, you know, we've been on the forefront, again, a small state working in collaboration with other states to try out, sort of pilot and show that these types of programs can work.
Very good.
The other is, our deregulated electricity market up here in the Northeast. You may know many other states in the U.S. are part of that type of market structure, but many are not. Many still have traditionally vertically integrated regulated utilities.
Mm-hmm.
What I think that experience here in Connecticut has shown us is that, we've been able to introduce more competition into how we generate electricity, and that's meant that we've gotten lower cost generation. And that results in savings for consumers.
Excellent. Well, the draft 2017 Connecticut Energy Survey focuses on five key themes, which we'll dig into a little bit more deeply. But we want to drive people to review those as early as today, because public comment is open. There's a 60-day public comment period, which ends on September 25th. And to facilitate those comments in an in-person environment, a number of public meetings have been scheduled across the state. So first, we want to get people to go to ct.gov/DEEP/energy strategy. There you can review or download and read the CES executive summary. or the full text of the strategy, and then turn out, if you choose, to one of the public meetings to provide input or ask questions. They start tomorrow, August 14th, at Webb Hall at Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic. Pick up on August 16th at Beacon Hall Events Center at the Housatonic Community College in Bridgeport. August 21st at Fort Trumbull State Park Conference Center in New London. The 29th at the Torrington City Hall. And on September 6th at the Gina McCarthy Auditorium, very appropriate, at the DEEP's Hartford office in Hartford, and then wrap up on September 7th at the Jones Auditorium at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station in New Haven. So we're on the line right now with Mary Soto. She is the Connecticut DEEP's Deputy Commissioner for Energy, and we've got about 5 or 6 more minutes left with you, Mary. So if you could move us through some of the high points of the 5 key themes that people need to kind of be aware of as they're reading through either the executive summary or the full draft of the CES report.
Definitely. Well, you know, I'll tell you, it is a comprehensive strategy. I think it's our draft here is over 200 pages. So you know, I think what you'll see in those themes is that we've organized our recommended goals and strategies around 3 different sectors. So we have goals and strategies around the power sector, around buildings and home heating, and then around the transportation sector. So through all of those sectors, what we're trying to advance is energy policy that supports our climate goals. Now, this, you know, we will also have a separate document coming up next year that will be a climate action plan once our Governor's Council on Climate Change makes some recommendations around what our midterm or 2030 climate target should be for the state. So this is an energy document that should be, you know, trying to align with and support those climate goals.
Mm-hmm.
And to support that, you'll see again this sort of focus on increasing our renewable energy deployment, looking at the conditions for a diverse zero carbon generation mix. So that includes, a focus on evaluating the role of nuclear energy in our resource mix. As well as looking at other ways that we can continue to deploy renewable energy, both considered behind the meter, sort of the smaller scale stuff, solar on your rooftops,
mm-hmm.
Shared clean energy programs, as well as this focus on our large scale renewables where we can get sort of a bigger bang for the buck, so to speak. But we also have a focus on trying to support grid modernization. And that's a term that you hear a lot, and it can mean a lot of different things. But for us, it means, you know, trying to embrace and find new ways to innovate this grid of the future. So part of that means a more resilient grid. So we have a microgrid program that was developed in the last few years, I think the first in the nation, in fact, the first state program to actually deploy. I think we have 5 operational microgrids now, and we want to continue that program and expand it further throughout the state. So, you know, a grid of the future would be one that can island off, is the sort of the term. So provide more resiliency in the face of, extreme weather events or other outages to keep critical facilities intact and online.
Excellent. There's also, there's also a push to enhance convenience for folks purchasing electric vehicles.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, I think when we look at the, from a climate perspective, the kind of electric vehicle deployment that would be needed, or the conversion of, you know, internal combustion engines to electric vehicles, thinking of that process, you know, we know there's positive trends there. A number of auto manufacturers have said that they're making the commitment to increase the number of EVs that they're producing and also stop producing, fossil fuel consuming vehicles into the future. But for us, I think our transportation chapter really tries to focus on, again, that decarbonization goal. But as you mentioned, also just thinking more broadly about how can we make clean and accessible transportation options even greater for, you know, for Connecticut citizens. So some of the things that we did since 2013 as a state, you know, were to expand the CT Fast Track. So, you know, bus rapid transit systems, dedicated lanes for buses, particularly around the Hartford area. I think those programs have been more successful than was predicted. So that's a positive trend we can build on. But also thinking about, you know, if we're going to want more folks to buy electric vehicles, then we need to have the infrastructure to support that.
Right.
So that means more charging stations in the places where people are going to want to charge their vehicles. And, you know, the reality is all of that, you know, comes with a cost. So
yes,
we need to figure out the best ways to finance those options.
Very good. Well, if any of this conversation has been stimulating to you, we once again want to drive you to ct.gov/DEEP/energy strategy to review the draft of the 2017 Connecticut Energy Strategy. Feel free to comment on them. The comment period is open now and into late September, September 25th, as a matter of fact, and statewide workshops and Q&A sessions are beginning as early as tomorrow. You can get all the information and head out to one of those as well. Our guest this morning is Mary Soto. She's the Connecticut DEEP Deputy Commissioner for Energy, and I guess we'll be coming back around to talk to you once this second report is generated in about a year, Mary. So great to meet you, and thanks so much for being part of the program. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voket@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voket, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.